Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers On-Demand Agrotourism Training. For more information, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even one or two bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Melissa Fuster for Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, in for Coral Lee. Can food serve as a tool to build bridges in times of conflict? Asri Amram takes us to the Palestinian town of Kafr Kasim, the site of a massacre in 1956, which today serves as the site for food tours for Israeli Jewish food tourists. Asri is completing his doctoral degree in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology of the Ben Gurion University in Israel, examining Jewish-Palestinian relationships in food spaces. Asri, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for coming. Thank you for joining us again. So let's begin with your dissertation work. What motivated you to focus on using food spaces to examine Jewish-Palestinian relationships?
Well, maybe I'll start with the whole problematic situation between the Israeli Jews and mm-hmm. the Israeli-Palestinian situation in Israel. First, I want to make clear that we are talking about 20% of Israel's population, as opposed to what we call the Palestinians who live in the occupied territories, which is the Palestinian Authority.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about 20% of Israeli citizens who live within Israel's border, and they have allegedly the same rights and duties as any other citizen in Israel, but we also know that they are formally and informally being discriminated.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm talking about the relations between Israeli Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel, I'm practically talking about intercultural relationships inside Israel. So why it's so interesting? Because since 1948, and maybe a little bit earlier, these relationships are always tense.
Mm-hmm.
Always tense, and it always changes due to political and security situations that we have in here. And from our side, as an Israeli Jew, we always see them, of course, generalized, as enemies, and they always see us as conquerors.
Mm.
And this is a problem left unresolved.
Yeah, it is a very, very complicated subject, as you thankful for that introduction. So how is your experience studying these very complex subjects in Israel? As you know, and especially as an anthropologist, you know that we often have very special and often personal connections to our research. So how do you think your own experience comes in as you approach this subject?
Well, I think the first thing that I heard when I told people that I'm renting an apartment in Kfar Kassim, this small town in central Israel, everybody asked me, weren't you scared? Did they try to harm you? Were you disguised or came as you are? And I think that shows us exactly how people think about people who live in the next city next to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, about 20 minutes from Tel Aviv, and those are cities or towns that people not usually go into, mostly to fix their car maybe, or to have some very good, authentic local dinner or lunch. And this is where the food spaces that I'm researching going in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought to myself, if Jews and Palestinians in Israel are relating through food, that would be a good place to research that thing. That would be a good place to see those relationships between the Israeli Jews and the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Hence, I looked at about three spaces, different spaces, which I looked a little bit different on each one of them. For the first one is like bakeries and the restaurants and food stands and the cafes, which have some kind of population that comes there.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is the city local market, which operates on Saturdays, and it's a very popular place. And the third one, which we're going to elaborate a little bit later, is food tours for Israeli Jews that come, go on a bus, and go for a short trip around town.
Yeah, no, and we will definitely dive into those very interesting food tours that, you know, your piece does such a great work at describing. But before we do, I'm interested to see if you can tell us a little bit about what you have found in these other spaces, like the bakeries and the market.
Mm-hmm.
And the restaurants.
Excellent. So, for example, when I'm talking about the popular local market of Kfar Kassim, it's a very unique space where Jews and Palestinians work, shop, and hang out together. I found in this specific place that it offers some alternative social and political space for various groups which are suffering from oppression in the Israeli society. The market, I think, carries some elements of non-formality that allows low-income people, for example, or immigrants and illegal workers to feel somewhat comfortable in these spaces. It is a whole different population than the one I meet, for example, in the other food spaces like restaurants, cafes, food stands, and bakeries. In there, I found a whole different components of the environment that there is. For example, there I found something that I wasn't expecting to find at all. Due to extensive field work, I came to realize that many of the food business in Kfar Kassim relate one way or another to this issue of kashrut. You know what kosher means, the Jewish dietary laws?
It will be great if you can explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, in general, there are some basic kosher laws that the Jewish dietary is mainly not eating pork, also the separation of dairy products and meat, and also not eating seafood and other things that don't have, which are not fish, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So this is as opposed to halal,
yes.
Islamic rules, which basically means no eating pork and not drinking alcohol beverages and some other things that you have in the fifth surah of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found during my field work is that Palestinian business owners adjust their food to the Israeli Jewish taste. And they are serving several dishes which has certain shades of kosher. I call this chapter 50 Shades of Kosher, because I actually found some ways that they define kosher, which Israeli Jews don't define it. And of course, in Israel, I don't know if everybody knows, I guess most of our listeners don't know, the kosherness is like held as a monopoly in the hands of the chief rabbinate of Israel, the authority that are responsible for the religious issues in Israel. So what I see in those spaces, for example, is a negotiation, an ongoing negotiation over the concept of kashrut. And then I found three different patterns. For example, one of them is what I call interceding kashrut, where people suggest Israeli Jew diners to have dishes that has some elements of kosher in. They allow you to separate some of the things that, some ingredients that you may find inside, and give you dishes without this specific ingredient that makes it non-kosher. And all those routes, all those ways of presenting a Palestinian kosher food, which is a combination I'm still not sure of, I guess it's part of their willingness, the business owners, to participate in shaping and redefining the components of the Israeli culture while criticizing its Jewish nature. As you know or not know, Israel is the Jewish state by definition. So it has always this inherent tension between her being democratic and her being Jewish state. So this negotiation just fills the void.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And is there pushback from Palestinians for these businesses to accommodate to the Jewish-Israeli dietary laws?
One more time?
No, it's just that I'm wondering that it is very interesting what you mentioned, that how local businesses, Palestinian businesses, right, are accommodating to the Jewish dietary laws. And I'm wondering if you have found any pushback from people that follow, for example, the halal dietary laws.
Well, it's very interesting because first and foremost, kosher has this very unique label of being supervised and clean, also in the U.S., I guess. And some of the customers, which are also local customers, Palestinian ones, they also sometimes prefer their food being kosher. And then try to ask people how come this kosherness is important for them. So first, everybody in business saying that it's for us to expand our clientele. We want people having the ability to eat in our places. But if you go deeper, you understand that it is so much more than this. Sometimes they actually say it's not worth it economically. So you have to go and ask them about the social and political reasons that they are doing it. And then you find out that sometimes people say, well, this is what I think how I should treat a minority in my business, meaning kosher eating Jews that come to eat in Palestinian cities. They are now the minority. So they are actually presenting what is the proper way to treat minority, as what they see. That's the first idea I heard. Second one is for very, very unique and quite rare places that are fully kosher, means supervised kosher by the chief rabbinate of Israel, and they are telling me that they prefer sometimes to have their food adjusted. While we know what the meaning of changing food, sometimes it would may hurt the tradition of the maker, of the Palestinian heritage, of the Palestinian kitchen. And he says it is much more important for him to go and to reach out for people that may never try Palestinian food if it won't be kosher. So it's a negotiation they think about every time. And of course, we in food studies, we know sometimes what is the outcome of such hybrid foods. We know sometimes that it is hides this notion of post-colonialism, of people who have to do some kind of adjustments just to survive. But I think this case is a bit differently because the Palestinian business owners hold the key. They don't have to. It means little bit, very little of their actual clients. I mean, it's their perception of what kosher is, not so much of the Jewish clients. And it's their perception in what they should act as Israeli citizens. And they know, I think, now more than ever, their ability to change what Israel means today, which is mainly Jewish-centered culture. And I think more and more we're going to see what I hope to see, and I think this is like more of my bottom line of what I see in those old food spaces, what is created to be an Israeli-Palestinian kitchen, which is today, of course, like oil and water. They don't mix. But I do believe that in this specific case that I have, that the Palestinian business owners are agents of change, and they are taking the responsibility of doing it.
It's such a interesting topic, and thank you for bringing that perspective. That is something that is not covered in the article, but it brings a very nice background to when we now move to talk about those interesting food tours. So, if you can. So your article, again, it focuses on food tours in this Palestinian town that was also the site of a massacre. So in order, before we get more into the tours and the very interesting complexities within that tour, those tours, can you give us a background of the town and also this unfortunate incident that happened in 1956?
Yes, I'll try to do it short.
I know, but it is I will say that when I read your piece, you did such a... I'm sure you spent so much time trying to go to the point because it is a lot of history that you put in here. So please go ahead.
Of course. So this town, this small town, Kfar Qasim, is a small town in central Israel. Like I told you, about 20 minutes from Tel Aviv, not that far from Jerusalem as well, which inhabited by 25,000 inhabitants, citizens of Israel, all Muslims. And they are citizens of Israel since 1948, since the war. On October 29, 1956, it was just before a war we call the Suez War, which was all the way down south of Israel. But a night before this war started, a night curfew was imposed on Kfar Qasim and other Palestinian communities all around. Then they were only 1,000 people. So the peasants returning from the field were not aware of the time of the curfew, that it was moved forward. And then, when they came back, they saw these border police officers who were ordered to shoot them for violating the curfew, which they didn't know on. So this very, very unfortunate case of 49 men, women, and children that were murdered is like the main thing that people think of when they hear Kfar Qasim in Israel. It's a specific case that is known in the Israeli Jewish culture as an extreme case of giving an illegal order, of course, that must be disobeyed. After this massacre event, every soldier who joins the Israeli army now learns about this specific case and know that he should, of course, disobey when he hears this kind of illegal order. This is what we call a clearly illegal order in Israel. Mm-hmm. So many of the locals still today feel that the massacre have yet received the state recognition. There's no Memorial Day, which is inside Israeli Jewish calendar, for example. They, of course, memorize it, but in Israeli education system, for example, there's nothing about it, nothing formal.
Yeah.
And the families of the murdered and injured will never probably compensated. To this day, the people of Kfar Qasim feel that justice has not been done, and the state just didn't took the responsibility over this case. I think a few years ago, Rubi Rivlin, our current president, went there and asked them for forgiveness. And of course, they gave him very big honor, but they still couldn't get it as a real apology, because as long as nobody mentions it every day life or calendarly, it's like never taking the full responsibility of this case. And the specific soldiers that were involved were all convicted and sent to jail, but later on they were pardoned. Okay, that's about the case itself. About the tour itself, we're talking about Ramadan night, which is culturally centered tours, meaning you are reaching out for people, a whole different people than the one who come for the local market, different population, the one who you would see buy in the bakeries and the restaurants. It's more high income, what we call in Israeli Ashkenazi, which is former Eastern Europe Jews, who comes to this, of course, left-wing identified people who are coming to this tour. And the same as like food tourism, the whole idea of this thing is you can actually bring people to talk about one thing, but eventually you are talking about something else. It means you are talking about the customs of the Ramadan and about fasting and feasting and about the cultural habits of this festive. But when you are walking those streets, of course you cannot ignore some of the things that just pop to your eyes, and then you have to ask some questions. Yes. You may ask, what about the sewage and the junk in the streets, for example? Or if you see some graffiti of Jerusalem, then people may ask, what does it mean? And usually it means something that is heavily related to their main narratives as Palestinians, and of course as Palestinian citizens of Israel. So the whole idea of food touring in these specific places, I argue in this specific paper, that it allows us, the uniqueness of food tours, to have some controversial messages, some hard to get knowledge inside those tours.
And
many people are going there to get one thing and getting the other, but in a good way.
Yes,
and of course, sometimes surprised, but it makes them think, and I think this is part of the discussion that is later on in the center of the tour itself.
Yes, and we'll dive right into that, but first, let's take a quick break. And when we return, we'll really dive into those complexities.
This This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers On-Demand Agritourism Training. Did you know that every $1 invested in tourism marketing returns on average $3 to $8 back? Not a bad ROI. Learn how to grow your agritourism business via 12 workshops entirely women-led. These training workshops are on demand and can be downloaded at any time. The local travel landscape is rapidly changing to meet the demands of the leisure, event, and corporate travel sectors. Whether you're a farmer or producer, a winemaker, a restaurateur, or a destination marketing organization, there's more opportunity than ever to capture these markets. The on-demand agritourism training will provide you with insights and skills to keep your target demographic coming back for more. 14 speakers providing 6+ hours of education that you can watch at your convenience, anytime, on any device. Maximize your time, budget, and resources, and focus on creative solutions to help your business thrive. Presented by Escape Maker and Fulton Stall Market, the full conference access pass is now available to purchase. Use the code HERITAGE2020 for $50 off a full pass at checkout. For more information and to purchase your pass, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
And we're back. This is Melissa Fuster from Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies in Fort Coraly. Before the break, Asri was starting to tell us a little bit about these food tours in this Palestinian town that was also the site of the massacre. So you mentioned, and one thing that's very interesting about these tours is that they take place during Ramadan, as you just explained before the tour. Before we get deeper into the tours, could you share with our listeners the significance of this holiday and how it is observed in Palestine?
Shortly, I will say that Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, in which, according to religion, Muslims fast from morning until nightfall. So paradoxically, we're talking about food and food tours in specific days that none of the people around us are eating. Everybody's fasting, and the tour participant eat. And later on, it ends with iftar. After the tour, most of the tours go and sit in this local home where they're having the iftar, which is the fast-breaking dinner, where after long day of fasting, everybody enjoys an amazing, rich dinner. And you know what? While mentioning it, I'll give you an example why it's so absurd, the thing that we are dealing with food in a day where most of our people that we are visiting are fasting. So, for example, just right before we sit down for the iftar, for the fast-breaking dinner, we go for a market. And this is a very, very small market that sells things that you need just before you start your dinner. And this place has about 15 food stands that are already in place when the group arrives, an hour, maybe an hour and a half before the breaking of the fast. The site is full of shoppers. Many people are there just to go and have their last things that they need. And of course, many of the tourists ask, can we buy it and eat it in spot, or we need to keep it for later? The tour guide, which is a local one, he replies, no problem, you may eat it. Anyone in here can see that you are not from here, not from around. So this is kind of their hospitality. But in the same way, of course, we know that it sounds a little bit strange for people eating in front of other people who haven't ate for long hours now. So one of the cases I had is a particular popular stand where some youngsters were selling what we call awame, which is a sweet fried like donuts, small donuts, like the donut holes in Dunkin' Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
So one asked, if I know this amazing delight, and would you like to try it? And I said, no, thank you. I know it, and I'm from around here. You know, I'm not a regular tourist. I enjoy them very much. I'll take some in the bag, and I'll eat it later. And he says, come on, have one. It's a great one. It just came out of the oil. It's hot. It's great. It's the best now. And I said, well, sorry, I'll take it for later, and held it with this fork in front of my face. And I said, you know what? I'll have one. And I tasted it, and I said it was fantastic and tasted wonderful. And he looked at me and says, have you no shame? How can you do it in front of me when I'm fasting? So, of course, for a moment I was scared, but quickly I understood that he was laughing at me. And he and his friends, they were all joking. Said, no, it's fine. We're just joking. No problem. We don't care. So this incident, I see it as a negotiation of what I can and can't do. Of course, this specific area was a joke, but we know in the anthropological literature what joke means.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it hides so much of what we are really want to know about the situation. They want to check me out, and I want to check them out. And all the situation around this food shows me what I call symbolic negotiations. People that check borders, checking boundaries with one another.
Mm-hmm. No, and that was a very interesting anecdote. And I will say that there is also a very beautiful picture of that dish in the piece. So if anybody's interested, mm-hmm. they can look at it. And as I was, you know, with anecdotes like that, as a reader, I'm wondering, why were the food tours organized during Ramadan? Because it seems that there can be other times that you don't have this already added tension to a potentially, you know, tense situation. And is there pushback from people saying, stop bringing tourists here to eat while we're fasting?
Well, first thing, many people that see the tours are surprised and very happy about it,
mm-hmm.
because they never knew there's something to see in their place. This is a very common comment that I hear. What do we have to see in here? Why people want to come and see what we have to offer? That's first. Secondly, we're doing the Ramadan night tours because this is a very specific cultural, very colorful event that people would like you to see. Think about in other places, the Christmas markets,
mm-hmm.
or Christmas events. Those are very colorful and invite you to come in and hear a little bit about our customs, about what we eat around the holiday, and everything. So this is perfectly fit for those kind of tours. All year long, it's harder to bring people because there's no festivity around it.
Okay.
There's no colorful events. But as I said, once you are going in Kfar Qasim, first, like any other Palestinian town, like any other town in the world, when you are touring a place, you have to get the sense of a place. And as I said before, the Kfar Qasim massacre is so central to this city and town and people. It relics from this event is in every person. Everyone is from a family who were injured or murdered in this specific area. So when you are touring with local guide, you eventually get some of this. And of course, we have to know exactly how much to give from what. It means you can talk about food and then go around talking about the social order and the political situation in this specific town. And then people would say, no, we came for a food tour.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can maybe go on and talk about the food and the customs, and people would have to go and ask, come on, tell me something about you. Don't tell me about the food. I can go into Wikipedia and read about Awame and Musa Khan and those foods. But I want to hear you. I want to hear your story, the town's story.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are coming all together when you have this intensive food tour of 5 to 6 hours when you're doing different stops in this town. Of course, one of them has to be the memorial for the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
When I asked the organizers and the guide, can't you have it mentioned but not showing the memorial, the monument? He says, no, I won't. You can't understand Kfar Qasim if you don't stop at this point and talk a little bit about it. And of course, he's right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the same way you cannot understand, I don't know, Paris if you don't go to Eiffel Tower. Maybe you can, but you have to get some of this central feature of the town, central element of the town.
Yes, definitely. And in your, I mean, the central part of your article is the idea of digesting a massacre, which you explain how that is done, like in this interesting dance between talking about food and talking about the history of the town. But then you also mentioned, and I want to now take us from the markets to the experience of going into people's homes. Because again, the digestion of that massacre happens with this specific dish, right? So if you can tell us about that and the experience of being in someone's home eating this dish.
So first, I'm talking also digesting those harsh truths. Because when you're talking about the history, it's something that you need to digest when there's no other way to get it. But you're right that I'm taking it a little bit more figuratively when we go inside people's homes. Of course, many people say that this is one of the most influential things of the tour, because even if we heard some local guide speaking, if we saw some of the monuments and the places of town, to be in someone's home, we have intimacy, which is so central to hospitality and understanding people if you go into their home. So this is a major thing that I'm seeing when I hear people talking after this experience. One of the dishes that there is in this iftar, fast-breaking meal, is musahan. Musahan is a traditional dish of Palestinians in general, but particularly in Ramadan, and even more particularly, it is recognized with the Kfar Qasim Massacre Memorial Day. This is a dish of chicken, roasted chicken, on a pita bread, on a layer of fried onion, seasoned with a purple lemony spice called sumac.
Mm-hmm.
And the dish is served in every home in town in October 29, the day of the massacre. Hence, many people call it the day of the musahan, or they call sometimes the dish of the massacre.
Mm.
So when I ask people, how come this specific dish represents this day, which of course they eat it in Ramadan, the Israeli Jewish tourists, and not on the massacre day? First they say it's very important for them to have this dish because it's very representative of the Palestinian kitchen. But later on, when you ask them about the connection between this musahan, this dish, to the massacre, they have several interesting answers. Some says it is because a group of women was preparing the dish just as they received the news. Another version says that it is the massive amounts of onion required for this dish that causes the one who cooks it to cry. One suggested that it might be because it's a day off and it's it's a very, very hard to make dish.
Mm.
And the day of the massacre is each year it's a day off.
Mm-hmm.
So they have many time to prepare the dish. And one of the most common answers is that the end of October is, of course, the olive harvest in Israel. Olive harvest is something which is very affiliated with the Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians in general. And because it's the end of the olive harvest, many families have a large quantity of fresh olive oil, a significant component of the dish. So all of these answers are good.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing that is everybody knows, that the dish they are just eating right now, everybody eagerly and loving it, it's the massacre dish, and it's so recognized with the massacre and this day, which is so important to every citizen in Kfar Qasim.
Wow, yes, I know, and I do, I hope our listeners are, you know, become more and more curious, because again, there are so many interesting things in your piece that, you know, we cannot fit all of it in a single interview. But just to close, if I may ask you, and this is a big question, to see if we can answer it, you know, in a concise way. These tours are, as you explain now and also in your piece, are a great way to create these interactions. How are some, can you just share with us to close some insights that you have gained from these tours that could contribute to our understanding of the future of Israeli-Palestinian relationships? Do you see them, for example, as a positive sign of change of things to come?
Well, I'll take this answer for two parts. The first one is, theoretically, when I'm talking about food tours, I really believe, and you should read this paper with our listeners, I really believe that it's a very good way for any place to have people coming over, food tourism. It's a very good way to have them talking about social and political things that are included in the tour. Never mind what you want to show people, while you're walking the streets, you get some of the sense of a place. That's the theoretical idea of how to use food tours in places that need some spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
About Israeli Jews and Palestinian citizens' relations, when I'm looking at these urban food spaces, all of them, the local market, the food businesses, and the food tours, I see an ongoing negotiation of two cultures that want to check each other out all the time to see where it leads. And I believe it leads to a place where more and more Palestinian citizens of Israel would like to take more part of the Israeli culture. But as long as the Israeli culture, which is right now mainly Jewish-oriented, will be open to get their Palestinian heritage, their Palestinian past, their Palestinian identity as Israeli Palestinians. Of course, this is a phrase that today no Palestinian citizen will sign on. They call themselves Palestinian citizens of Israel, or the Palestinians in Israel, but never an Israeli-Palestinian, because Israeli includes being Jewish. And this is what they are criticizing about the Jewish nature of the Israeli state. And I do believe, as long as we go farther and farther, the Israeli culture and Israeli state would have to get some of their demands for recognition, for understanding the pain of the past. And I think that's the only way that we can go forward. And I think Israeli citizens are willing to do it in some ways. And food, sometimes we see it as reflecting other social fields. And I do believe that what we do easily today in food spaces, like hybridizations of dishes, like I showed you, with the kosher adoption, like the opening your homes to different tourists, like having these alternative spaces for people who are less recognized in the Israeli society. All of these places are enabling alternative way of treating each other as citizens in the same state. And I think from the Palestinian side, they would have to go and participate more, take more part of the Israeli society and culture, and the Israeli society and culture will have to be much more civic, much more naturalized to having it possible. Of course, having all the rights and all the duties of any citizen in Israel.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this work with us. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for having me. Of course. So for our listeners, if you would like to learn more about this research or other work featured in Gastronomica, visit gastronomica.org, where you can access the Spring 2020 issue for free until the end of the year, or follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, is an international interdisciplinary journal that presents new and original research, advances our understanding of compelling issues in the world of food, and invites critical debate and commentary across diverse audiences. We invite you to read and submit your scholarly and creative work. More details are available in our website. Gastronomica is supported by the University of California Press, and on behalf of the journal's editorial collective, I want to thank the Heritage Radio Network, Meant to be Eaten, and its host, Coral Lee, for allowing us to share this miniseries podcast.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.